Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Learn more and try a free sample at wildakpollock.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I like the way you do.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway. So does it seem like every cookbook and food blog is talking about families? I mean, especially like around the holidays, it seems like our quest in the kitchen is always about like cooking for crowds and, you know, nourishing our loved ones, expressing our love and community through our kitchen creativity. So I don't know, as a person who has cooked for myself for most of my adult life, so I don't know how many years that is, a while, you know, on a regular basis, that is, not when like having friends over. I mean, I can say that there's nothing wrong at all with talking about, you know, the graciousness of cooking for families, but it can get a little annoying. What about showing yourself a little love? So, well, I think it's long overdue that there should be a cookbook that really hones in on this topic of solo dining and solo cooking. I don't think I could have hoped for a more wonderful, important culinary icon to write it. So I'm really pleased to be talking with a legendary chef in New York City of Anissa, but also just beyond New York City, an iconic chef and restaurateur of our times. And she is known for, well, being a trailblazing chef in terms of her technique, her culinary philosophy, and blending a refined technique that she has been trained in with Chinese ingredients of her heritage, also for being a woman. So without further ado, thank you for joining us, Anita Lowe.
Thanks for having me.
So we know that Anissa, your restaurant in New York City's Greenwich Village of 17 years, it closed about a year ago.
Yep.
Is it sort of apt that about a year later you came out with a book all about like meditating on cooking for one? I mean, are you just like done with restaurants or?
No, I'm not done with restaurants okay. By any means. I'm done with owning a restaurant for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually wrote that book while Anissa was still running.
Okay.
So.
I guess it takes a while to cook, make a book. It
takes a long time to make a book. So, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it does seem, you know, so this is a subject that is close to you then. How long did it take you to write?
It actually didn't take that long. I mean, it didn't take that long. The recipes are so easy mm-hmm. that, it was kind of, you know, it was quick just to churn them out. And then the head notes, you know, they're short. So it wasn't, it wasn't that hard. I mean, once I got the proposal done, you know, it sort of wrote itself. So
right, okay. Yeah. So you were working on it while you were still working in the restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, I was off the line at that point because mm-hmm. you know I had this knee issue. Mm. So yeah, I had plenty of time, and it was great. They let me do all of my own recipe testing, which I thought was awesome because I could, you know, calibrate the recipes to taste the way I wanted them to taste, and it was great.
Yeah, so that's you make it sound easy, but that's a pretty big feat to juggle both things at the same time. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about your first cookbook, Cooking Without Borders, and that was more of like based on your restaurant.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. It's also subtitled, Cooking Without Borders itself implies that it's all about the multicultural approach in the American kitchen.
Yes.
Before we talk more about like the solo cooking, what's your take on blending, I guess, influences from multiple cuisines in the American kitchen?
I mean, I think that's American. I think, we're a country of immigrants. Mm-hmm. Of various backgrounds, and it's only natural. I think fusion is all food is fusion. I mean,
right.
Everything has been influenced by something else, mm-hmm. and it continues to evolve, much like language. And there was an article in the Times recently about, you know, identity and borders and stuff like that. But even like physical borders weren't always in the same place. So it, mm-hmm. I don't know how you can say it.
Yeah.
Things are put into, everyone wants to put everything into a box to understand it. And that's not quite reality.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you've been cooking in this way for much longer than we seem to be having a lot of conversations these days about the idea of blending influences and cultural appropriation, if you will, and mm-hmm. it's come up a lot lately. But people like yourself and chefs, have been doing this for quite some time. It's like nothing new. Do you find anything troubling about the idea of just anyone mixing and mashing and or taking on anyone else's cuisine that is not theirs and selling it to the public?
Well, I think that it's not so much the fact that someone should be interested in somebody else's cuisine and, mm-hmm. and doing that. The problem with cultural appropriation is that certain people get to benefit from it. Mm. So if it's someone who has more agency than mm-hmm. another group who is taking, say, Chinese cuisine and making a mint out of it, whereas, you know, the actual...
Wait, a mint out of it? Sorry.
Making a lot of money.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Got it. I was like, a mint? Wait.
a money mint or whatever yes. you want to call it. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, someone who, you know, like an actual Chinese person doing it never gets the... even now, I mean, the people who are making... you know, really high-end Chinese food, but, you know, perhaps not in, you know, a Western atmosphere or an expensive atmosphere. They perhaps don't speak English. They don't get any notoriety for that, you know, and it may be the best food ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's using incredible technique, and they've studied this forever. And, yeah, but...
there's plenty of those examples, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's all around us. I guess, I don't know why I just launched into this right away, but I guess it's been on my mind because have you heard about some controversies around Andrew Zimmern's new restaurant in the Midwest? Lucky, what is it called? Lucky Cricket. That's it.
Lucky Cricket. Does he serve crickets?
I know. Yeah. That's what I was wondering. Yeah. I was like, that's a little strange name, but okay. Yeah, I don't know. There's been talk about how he may have come off a little tone. His tone was a little off when he was describing it. But if that's not something...
I actually haven't, yeah.
Okay.
I'm aware of the restaurant. I'm not aware of what he said about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's always room for more sensitivity around this
subject. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely seems like it could be a tricky area. And so anyway, I mean, this book is really reflective, even though, you know, it's focused on cooking for one, but you really embrace a multitude of different cuisines, everything from duck ragu, chicken pho, you know, braised short ribs and so forth. It's really, I mean, would you put it in any culinary category? Like if anyone asked you like, oh, what kind of food is this?
You can't put it into a category. The thing is, when you're cooking for yourself, I mean, I like to eat multiculturally. Mm-hmm. I like to eat a variety of different things. And I think it's healthy to eat, you know. I mean, studies have been shown that if you're eating the same thing all the time, it's not as good for you as if you're eating diversely. So, mm-hmm.
It's just the way you cook.
Yeah. I mean, certainly something. I mean, is there anything that's... Yeah, there's some things that are pretty, I'm getting to that age where I can't remember words. It's so annoying.
They're classic. Take your time.
There are some classic recipes in there that, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, so I wouldn't say it's contemporary American because it's not. It's
like classics from many different,
yes.
Because I noticed you have like a classic French salad, for instance, with the cabbage and what do you call it, lardon, right?
Oh, yeah.
So all kinds of classics across the board.
Right. And some new stuff as well, you know, mm-hmm. or twisted things, if not, you know.
I love that you kind of have this really wry sense of humor throughout it. Not only are they, you know, recipes that are written for one, you know, person, ideally, but you could always scale up so it doesn't have to be. But, you know, you have bitter greens with torn bitter greens and, you know, like kind of like self-deprecating descriptors throughout in the head notes as well. Why did you decide to write a book about one? Just to back up a little bit.
You know, this actually came about because I was in a conversation with David Ransom, who has the Connected Table. Mm-hmm. He, for some reason, you know, I work with him every year on the SHARE breast and ovarian cancer fundraiser. And, for some reason we got on the subject of cookbook titles with my last name in it.
Ah.
Yeah, and it went on forever. You know, we had like Low Country Cooking. We had Low and Slow, the braising book.
Highs and lows.
Right, exactly. Low.
That's fun.
Low end. Yeah, whatever it was. And one of them was Solo and one of them was Alone. And I was like, oh my God, I have to write that. That'd be hysterical.
Oh,
like, it could be funny. It could be like, you know.
Yeah.
So.
And then you share your breakup stories a little bit, or like sad Valentine's Day meals and so forth. I don't know. I think that it's very relatable to anyone.
Thank you.
Yeah. You also sort of poke fun, you know, in the introduction, you write, you know, a lot of professional chefs say that they can't cook for fewer than 40 people, right? They're just so geared to cook on the line. But you write, those chefs who say they can't cook for fewer than 40 people, not me. I can do math. It is my Asian birthright.
Well, yeah. I almost majored in math, yeah.
Also, another thing I thought was interesting was that, you know, you learned to have a waste-free attitude in the kitchen, and that could be a little challenging when you're cooking for one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where does that stem from? You know, you mentioned your parents, they survived the Cultural Revolution and they instilled in this sense of, you know, wasting not and food is precious.
Yeah, but I mean, it came from that, mm-hmm. and it came from, even like working in French kitchens,
mm-hmm.
and I think French cuisine was born out of poverty and, yeah, there's just
an all cuisine, right?
Yeah, all the great cuisines were certainly. That was just sort of pounded into you not to waste anything, you know, in cooking school as well as, you know, the various places that I worked. I at Boulay,
mm-hmm.
the sous chef used to go through our garbage to make sure we weren't like throwing away something that was useful.
Wow. So something like a tops of the, like, I don't know, carrot greens that looked good or something like that, or?
Well,
like,
no, it wasn't. No? It wasn't. Okay. We hadn't taken it that far yet. But yeah.
Perfectly good ingredients.
Yeah, exactly. Or something that you could put into a stock, or you know, carrot peelings.
Got it. Yeah. Well, that's pretty far.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people have a hang up when it comes to cooking for one because they're afraid of buying too much stuff and then having it go to waste or spending too much on it. So I think this book really proves otherwise.
Thank you. Yeah.
So many topics that are covered in it, but we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude and we'll be right back chatting more with Anita Lowe.
This episode is brought to you by Wild Alaska Pollock, the fish of the future. Wild Alaska Pollock is incredibly delicious, highly nutritious, and perpetually sustainable. Among the last frontier's many natural wonders, Wild Alaska Pollock just might be the state's best-kept secret. This cousin to cod has lean, snowy white meat, delicate texture, and a mild flavor that makes it extremely versatile and tasty. Only pollock caught in Alaskan waters by U.S. fishermen can be labeled Wild Alaska Pollock. Unlike other pollock products, Wild Alaska Pollock is filleted and frozen just once within hours of being caught to preserve freshness, flavor, and texture. And now, food service professionals can try Wild Alaska Pollock for free. Request your sample at wildakpollock.com and discover the fish of the future. That's wildakpollock.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Anita Lowe, the chef of formerly Anissa Restaurant, and also the author of the new cookbook, Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. Just to mention, this book has gotten a lot of accolades recently. It's been listed as, like, you know, in the top cookbooks of the year, cookbooks of the fall. I've seen it everywhere. So congrats on that, Anita.
Thank you.
It's really exciting. And I love the illustrations. Can we talk about that briefly? They're, you know, usually when you walk into a cookbook store, all the books on the table will have these glossy covers filled with beautiful photography. But this one has a really fun, quirky, hand-drawn illustration.
Yeah, I mean, that was my editor's idea to hire Julia Rothman. Mm-hmm. I love her stuff. She's everywhere now. But I think it sort of goes with... the tone of the book. So I thought it was brilliant on her part.
Yeah, I think that the illustrations are amazing. And to anyone who says that you can't do like direction and like, you know, really show how to do something, I think the spread about the dumpling step-by-step process that is illustrated is a really great example of how that can be done in a really, really clever way. I love it.
Yeah, Rothman is talented.
Yeah. So why did you include dumplings in here? Because that's not something I would personally make for myself because it just takes a little too much work. I always would want to make some extra and then freeze it or something.
Well, yeah, that is not for one. I mean, that recipe is for many.
Many.
But yeah, I just thought it'd be funny because I think there's times when you've got nothing to do and you just need to fill time and... you might want to just luxuriate in that process, in that cooking process. And,
true.
I always like to have dumplings in my freezer just because it's something really quick and easy. And it's a balanced meal in a little pocket. It's got its vegetable, its starch, and protein.
Yeah. And this actually, this recipe you have seems pretty basic. It's pork and garlic chive dumplings.
Yeah, exactly.
So straightforward, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So not like your famous foie gras dumplings at Anissa.
Well, you could make that, I don't think that's something, that's just more of a celebratory thing. Like
right.
High-end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's super clever, though. I love that you write here, Well, yeah. I guess, you know, when you are cooking a large batch of dumplings, it's sort of investing in many meals for yourself later in the freezer. But you write, the folding is a meditative exercise. For each dumpling, think of all the good things you want for yourself in the future. If you're not too bitter, think of all the qualities of a perfect meat.
Yeah, I mean, there's something very meditative about cooking, especially, you know, folding and refolding something.
And doing it nicely.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. So, you know, that's something I would do.
Now, do you make the dough yourself when you're doing this often, or
No. The skins? No, I would. Well, if I'm doing it, you know, for the home, yeah, it's for home. It's you're gonna buy it. I think you could. My mom was really good at rolling that stuff out. But that is a really huge project if you're gonna like roll it out yourself. And you know, I think that's sort of like a family thing. You need two people at least to do that. Someone to roll it out. The next person to
stuff it. All right, so good to know. I'm not cutting corners when I buy prepackaged dumpling wrappers.
It's for you. I mean, no one's watching. Yeah.
True, but it is better when you roll them out. Anyway. Yeah. I love your take here on eggplant mapo tofu and your little story about how your mom sent you a package of index cards of her simple go-to recipes when you went to college.
Yes. Yes, and we had mapo tofu on there. I lost that. I lost that thing of cards.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But you remember this one at least.
Yeah, I mean, she made it with, you know, tofu. But
tofu and ground pork.
I think she used to make it with ground beef. But I think, you know, we grew up in, like, suburban Detroit. So, yeah, it might have been hard to get certain ingredients,
I can see that. Yeah. So your take on this is, was it hard to find tofu because you changed it to eggplant instead?
I think, I'm not quite sure why I did that. I love eggplant. love eggplant. Yeah.
It sounds brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a veggie side then.
Yeah.
Just squares of eggplant instead of those tofu. Perfect. I'm a little bit obsessed with this sauce because I recently wrote a piece about Lao Gan Ma's spicy chili crisp.
Oh, was that your piece?
Yeah.
Someone sent me that.
Story.
Yeah, that's hysterical. That's absolutely hysterical. Totally, I just totally read that. Yeah.
Oh my God, awesome. I mean. Yeah.
I didn't realize it wasn't a cult.
Yes, exactly. I should have called you for that because I had no idea. And of course, and then I get your book and you write about how you love it so much.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. Right? We had it on, we did a seafood boil this, the person who sent it to me.
Seafood boil.
Yeah, we had this huge like seafood boil out in my house this summer and we just put some Lao Gan Ma on it. I was like, oh my God, I'm doing this all the time now. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, so dipping the seafood or...
Yeah, well, you just take, I mean, it's hard to dip because it's, like, so crunchy, but you just take a little bit, we had, we had sweet shrimp, we had a whole bunch of crabs that I had just caught, and some other types of crab, and I don't remember what we had in there, but it was really fun.
Wow, that sounds like a great use for, I mean, nobody has said seafood boil yet to me when talking about Lao Gan Ma. That's awesome.
So good, yeah.
Yeah, and did you recently fall in love with this sauce, or was it always around, because, I don't know, growing up in the Midwest, did you...
No. I had gotten a... the woman who wrote who helped me write my first cookbook, Charlotte Druckmann, gave me a jar of this chili crunch.
Yeah.
Which I was obsessed with. And I gave a jar of it to my brother. And, my sister-in-law was like, oh, have you had the Chinese version of this? I was like, no. Just, oh, you have to get this. You have to get this. It's called Lao Gan Ma, and you have to get the one with the really unhappy woman on the on the label. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went out and got it, and I was like, oh my God, yeah. I was like, because I had been making a sauce that kind of tasted like that. And, you know, it was complicated. It was like, it wasn't crunchy, but it was it was like a complicated sauce to make. And I was like, wow, I can just buy it.
There you go. Yeah. That's hilarious. Well, you know, I love that you don't shy away from those, like, you know, kitchen helpers and just like all the things that you love throughout this book. And I just have to ask, like, since, you know, you've trained at Escoffier, you've worked at Boulay, and you've worked in a lot of, you've cooked for the Obamas and President Xi Jinping at the White House.
Yes.
It's amazing. How has your, throughout your career, your food philosophies or kitchen tendencies evolved in throughout your career?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I know the answer to that. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it, my cooking got fancier at one point.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, and then recently, it's gotten more rustic again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Because I think it's interesting. This book is all about, like, you know, obviously it's, your, an you know, accomplished chef, but this is all about cooking at home, things that you just want to throw together for a simple meal. So it's fun to see that side of your creativity in a book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm cooking at home now, so I don't have the restaurant, and in my New York City apartment, it's tiny. It's not, you know, particularly that well equipped. It's just you want to make things that are quick and easy.
Yeah. Yeah. So now that it's about holidays, what would you say to anyone who, I don't know if anyone spends the holidays really by themselves, but maybe has a really small crowd, doesn't, you know, want to go too crazy with cooking. Any suggestions maybe from your book for something really simple?
Yeah.
Small gathering?
Yeah, there's a squab recipe in there that I think is appropriate for this time of year. It's, you know, it's got carrots, and squab is expensive, so it's a little bit more celebratory.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's easy. It's basically just a some roasted carrots and some broiled squab, I think.
Perfect.
That
sounds fun.
Yeah, and then there's also desserts in there.
So, yeah, that's true. Yeah, so it sounds like the fun is like getting a unique protein, maybe, and then just cooking it simply. It's a good formula.
Absolutely. Yeah, why not? I mean, you know, get something that you wouldn't normally buy, you know, and yeah, so it's just a little bit more fun and
yeah, cool. All right. Well, that's about all the time, but I do have to ask, now that you've written your second cookbook, you know, you're on to new projects, what is the next, are you working on any other cookbook down the pipeline, or do you have any plans for any big projects coming up?
Yeah, you know, I'm a little bit scared to write this next one just because this one has done so well. Yeah, I will definitely write another cookbook. I've been doing some work with the Tour de Forks, hosting some culinary travel, and I'm hoping to get some sort of long-term consulting gig with a, you know, and open a restaurant. We'll see. But cool. I don't want to own one. So
I see. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you so much for writing this book, which I've wish I'd had for so long. Now
thank
it's
you.
Existent. All right. Well, everyone check out Solo, just out from Knopf. And you can also follow Anita at handle Anita Low NYC, Twitter on Instagram. And thanks to everyone from Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Monday, December 3rd, is our annual gala, Winter in the Garden, and you are invited. Celebrate the season with Heritage Radio Network at the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. It's the one night of the year where you can show your support for HRN while sipping on champagne, hanging out with our hosts, and bidding on one-of-a-kind silent auction items. VIP hour goes from 6 to 7, featuring a tour of the Bonsai Room. At 7, all of our guests can sample bites from some of our favorite chefs. Head to heritageradionetwork.org/gala for tickets.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.